You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. We welcome Lydie Klotz back to the podcast. Lydie studies and writes about design and problem solving. He has over 80 peer-reviewed articles in scientific journals, including Nature and Science, and numerous articles and publications such as The Washington Post, Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, and Scientific American. We first talked to Lydie about his book, Subtract, The Untapped Science of Less, a book I absolutely adore. And today we're talking to him about his new book, also terrific. It's called In a Good Place, How the Spaces Where You Live, Work, and Play Can Help Us Thrive. You're going to love this podcast. Lydie Klotz, welcome back.
Thanks, Kelly. It's great to be here.
I was trying to figure out how to start this conversation. And so here's what I want to do, if it's okay with you. I want to have you do a science audit of my office.
Okay.
All right.
That's a good idea.
Okay. So here, and I can't move. I tried just doing this earlier and I was knocking crap over. So it's going to be somewhat limited, but I have a ton of books. So that's the small thing. There's stacks of books here. There's like more stacks of books there. This sign is the original Second City sign when we opened the theater years and years ago down the street. So it would be in 1959. Framed copy of a Second City album. The yes that you see there used to be yes and, but the and got burned in the fire when my office caught on fire at Second City. So I just have the yes. And to me, like, I don't know, it's funny to me. So that's why I just have that. And then I don't think you're going to be able to really see this, but so I have my desk and then I have two chairs, like comfy chairs, when I want to have a conversation with someone, but I don't want the barrier of a desk between us. So okay. I will move out from there, sit next to them. I'm on the same level and there's a little lamp there and we can have that conversation. So, okay. All right. Science me up in my office.
How are you doing? I think, yeah, that's I love this. So let me start with the, the idea in the book, right, is that we have this relationship with our surroundings and that I talk about the core things that our surroundings can give us are basically agency, growth, and connection. And so let's look at for agency with your office. I mean, one thing that I love is that you clearly are in charge there, right?
And yeah, I'm in charge.
And a lot of us are in charge of our office, but maybe don't use the agency, right? So you've thoughtfully put things where you want them to be. And you talked about the chairs and that's the, you know, just this feeling of being able to like interact with our spaces is really key. And so you're doing well there from my perspective on the agency. The growth, let's go to connection next. That's a little easier. So, I mean, we think about connection in spaces, obviously with other people. So you mentioned the two chairs. And I think what's cool is that you're thinking about, it's not necessarily that two chairs is right for every situation. You're just thinking about, okay, there's going to be situations when I have people coming into my office and here's how I want them to feel. And that's really important because, you know, if you think about yourself going into somebody else's office, right? If the space is kind of, maybe it's too impressive or you're distracted by how fancy it is, or, you know, there's shin guards and boxer briefs strewn on the floor, which is like my house.
Yes.
But those things are going to prevent the person who comes in from like connecting with you, which is what you want probably to happen. The other part of connection though, is that like the connection to the space. So I like that you've got, you've put the, so And the connection to the space is something that's very, that can give us those same feelings that, you know, connecting with other people can. And so you've got the artifacts from the past, which is really cool, because then, you know, you're kind of, the space is keeping that top of mind for you. And then growth, I guess, is, you know, we talk about growth is number one. I guess the books are a good example.
The books. Of this, that's right? What I thought. Yeah.
And so, and again, obviously the growth comes from like opening the books up and reading them, but just the fact that you're displaying them is showing that you're like, okay, this is, I'm a work in progress, right? I'm always going, I can always get better by doing like looking at books. So I think that's really cool. The other element of growth, I guess, is just like spaces that push you beyond your comfort zone just a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want all spaces to do that, and you don't want it to be too far out of your comfort zone. But if there are ways where you're like, okay, figuring out how to operate the window and get some fresh air in here in the summer, like that made me feel good about being able to, you know, learn about thermodynamics a little bit. So I'll give you an A on your office.
Excellent. I wasn't looking for a grade, but I appreciate the A. You know, and part of what I do is I leave my office throughout the day to put myself into other spaces. And I've always been like that in terms of like, I can't sort of sit still. And right. you're also making me think of, I once had a boss who, he had this really long desk, and he would sit at one end, and then you were supposed to sit at the other, like a cartoon dining room table situation.
And was it intentional?
Oh, totally. It was a total status play. And I, at a certain point, I refused to play that game, and I just came right next to him.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, and then my most recent boss, who just left the company and made me very sad because I liked him a lot, he also had two chairs. He did the thing I did, which is if I'd come in, he'd go sit on my same, you know, level. And he went to the University of Michigan. And if you know anyone who went to the University of Michigan, they're so obnoxious. So there was like always like a Michigan basketball, you know, or a Michigan other thing. I'm like, okay. And so there's a way you talk about the setup of this book. You and I do a same thing, and have done the same thing, which is take our kids to bookstores. So this is sort of legendary in my family in terms of like, oh, we go to the bookstore, we go to different sections, and then we'd come together and we'd go to a cafe afterwards. And sometimes when the kids were little, we'd be reading to them, then they'd be reading to us and whatever. But you note that you have sort of two passions when you walk into a bookstore, but they're not in the same section.
So I like the behavioral science and the applied behavioral science. I think that's just, to me, what's going on in the brain is so fascinating. And this, quite frankly, like new frontier that we're learning so much about so quickly that is so relevant to everything we do. And then I like design and the way that the physical world is. But those are obviously in different sections. So the behavioral science, the applied behavioral science is one place, and then the design of the physical world is totally different section in the bookstore, which is, like I point out, is unfortunate. I understand that why you need to have different sections for different topics, but there is a ton of overlap between what's going on in our head and what's going on in our outer world. And I think that there's, you know, what I tried to do with this book is connect some of that in a way that's useful for readers.
Yeah, that struck me. And it in part, and we've had this conversation before, you and I, but this things happen in your life, trials and tribulations, other things, age, all these things. And what keeps coming back to me is how these things are all connected, and that you if you are not paying attention to the outer, you are doing that to your peril. If you're not paying attention to the inner, you're doing that to your peril. And because they are connected, and whether it's, you know, so I haven't talked about this in the pod yet, but I'm going in for open heart surgery in 3 weeks. And it's terrifying, right? But I got diagnosed nearly 10 years ago. It was like 8 years ago with this heart murmur. I have a leaky valve, got to get a valve replacement. It's a very common thing. But what I had to do at that point, my cardiologist is like, all right, diet, exercise, you know, dental, you got to pay attention to all these things that frankly you're not paying attention to. And the minute I started doing that, what maybe seemed like a chore was actually a complete gift, because I was lining up things that I had not been lining up. Like, oh, if I feel more healthy in my body, my mind is going to be clearer. I'm going to be better to do things. It's like that knowledge is freely accessible to all of us, yet rarely gets put together. And I don't know why.
Yeah. And I mean, I think you do see things that are like, this is how it, you know, being in green spaces makes you feel good because it's a connection to nature. But when it gets to these kind of core needs that we assessed in your office, which is like the agency, competence, and connection, and these are like our basic emotional needs, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And they're not only met by our surroundings, but like they originated from this relationship with our surroundings. So that to me is just mind-boggling that they're not put together more.
So let's talk about your origin story here, which starts with your dad, who was doing field research. Yeah. Like, how do you get involved in learning about beavers and how they build things?
Yeah, my dad he's a retired biology professor, and we grew up in upstate New York. And he got a grant, I think, probably to study the downstream effects of beaver dams. So, like, what would happen in the streams with the phosphorus after? And so we had to like go around and talk to people whose fields had been dammed up by beavers and try to get permission to study them. Which, I mean, the people in that. That's not a common reason that people were coming to their front doors.
Right? No.
This is like rural upstate New York, and you've got an awkward biology professor coming up and being like, hey, can I study your pond? And one of the ones that is like seared into my brain is this guy who had, he was already mad because the fish had all died in his pond, and he thought there was some conspiracy behind that. And my dad was then coming to like ask about studying that. But I don't know, maybe I'm sure some of the kind of, you know, looking at the world as and trying to figure out what's going on comes from following along behind my dad. But of course, the reason that ties into the book is because, you know, beavers are building animals, right? And they build their huts, obviously, to provide shelter, but they also like change the whole ecosystem in their favor, right? Because you've got the hut, and now you've got a lake around it, and the predators can't get to the hut, and the beavers also create a whole place where food that they want to eat can then be. So I use it to talk about my background a little bit, but also to illustrate that, like, hey, this thing, engaging with our surroundings, is not just a human thing. This is any living thing needs to pay attention to the relationship with their surroundings.
All right, so take us from that idea to your then 2-year-old daughter Josie making drip sandcastles, and why you should not intrude on that process.
And I use the drip castles to. That to me illustrates what the analysis we did with your office, but it also shows just how basic it is. So anybody who's ever watched kids at the beach knows that when they go, all these different things to do, inevitably they will start building in the sand, right? And Josie, I think the more advanced kids build drip castles, right? So the drip castles is like trickling the sand through your hands, and it creates like spires, like frozen fountains. But if you think about what's happening and what's making that enjoyable for the kid, right, there's agency there. They are in control of this, right? And as much freedom as we think we give our kids, like, their whole life is determined by what grown-ups and babysitters are allowing them to do. And all of a sudden they go to the beach and they can do whatever they want, and the first thing they want to do is build in this sand. So there's agency, there's also growth. If you think about what they're learning, and this is why you shouldn't intrude on the process. I mean, she's literally learning stuff that, you know, fourth year engineering students are learning about, you know, material properties and fluid dynamics. And so, you know, figuring out how much moisture in the sand makes it pack down, figuring out how tall something can go without falling apart. So that's the growth through building. And then the connection the natural evolution of any of these building projects, right, is the kid does as much as they can and then realize they could do more if they had more people around, right? And this is very similar process to why hunter-gatherer tribes came together. It's like in the origins of civilization was, hey, they wanted to be able to build bigger things, and they needed more than one tribe to be able to do that. And so anyway, back to the beach, Josie would recruit her cousins and, you know, send the grown-ups down to get pails of water. And all of a sudden you've got this, this connection that's happening in the act of shared building, which of course bonds people together too, right? Because now you're all invested in the project and you've worked on something together and you're learning about each other. So, that's how it went to, you know, observing beavers to observing two-year-olds.
I'm realizing this as I'm talking to you right now, because I posted about this on social media because I said I was feeling nostalgic. So I went and visited my hometown, which is maybe 40-minute drive from Chicago, Kenilworth, Illinois, and I saw my parents' house and the grade school and the high school, and I got out and I walked around, and I was realizing, I think I was inspired by the book because I was reliving all the way this space built me. And, you know, so where I played soccer on this field, where I, even as a younger person, played, you know, we were right behind the train tracks. We were always playing on the train tracks, which I know sounds terrible, but none of us got killed. So, you know, but, you know, it brought back all these memories, and it wasn't just like me alone. It was like, oh, I did this with my brothers here, or this with my team here, or, you know, my new group of friends when I went to high school. And that relationship is back and forth. You know, there's ways it built me and there's ways I helped it build, but mm-hmm. No one was ever alone. That's the thing. It was like, it was me, other people, and the space I'm in.
Yeah. Well, that's remarkable. I mean, just the space as a like repository of memory. You telling that story, I'm literally going in my head and all of a sudden having this vivid recollection of like, we would walk from our high school to the soccer field.
Yep.
On train tracks for like half a mile of the trip. And I'm thinking about my buddies. I'm thinking about that soccer field, which was like next to a junkyard. And as I was doing the research for the book, I didn't know this before, but just the way that our brains have evolved, you know, so they were originally the networks in our brains that dealt with spatial things are the networks that became adapted when we started to have like human relationships. So like the human relationships and the spaces are literally like in the same spot in our brain. And there's all kinds of interesting examples. I mean, like the memory champions who do these memory competitions will associate the things they're trying to memorize with spaces because that helps them then recall them. But you know, we can use it in our daily lives to just, like you said, you go back and reminisce and all these memories coming flooding back and you don't really care that much about the railroad tracks, but you do care about the people that you're thinking about because you went to the railroad track. So I think that's it's a really cool example of just how linked these things are.
Well, I guess that also ties in to, there's been some research on, and I know it from working here, that many actors will actually memorize their lines when they're doing blocking. So when they're being sort of told, okay, this is where you need to be on the stage at this time, and so they are tying up those things. And when I remember, we were on vacation a couple of years ago, and our son Nick was outside memorizing his lines from Hamlet in the pool. So he'd literally be moving along and we'd be hear him doing his Shakespeare. He's a Shakespearean actor now. He's very good at memorizing lines, but he's never sitting still when he's doing that.
Interesting. It's like the inverse of one of the favorite, you know, when you write the book, they want you to put in tips of how people can use this.
Yes.
And so I was, and one of my favorite tips that like I've used since is kind of reversing that process, where it's like, if you, now when I have a conversation with my son Ezra, if I want it to stick, I try to move it to a new place. You know, just, okay, let's walk around the block and do this conversation, as opposed to, because I think this stayed in the book, but I remember like where I got the talk from my mom, right? And it's so now like the Lego room is ruined forever.
It's ruined. Conversation.
It's just cool that like once you recognize that connection, there's all kinds of ways you can use it intentionally.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So every once in a while, there's a line from a book or a concept from a book that I'm like, I can't shake this, and I have to tell everyone I know about it. So you have one of those moments with me, and it's the concept of bike shedding.
Okay, yeah.
Take us through this story, because this is so brilliant. And the way my friend Liz, who's our she's the recently announced co-president of Second City after our CEO left. And I told her, and her eyes went bright, and she goes, "This explains everything."
That's funny. So it's one of these. So the concept of bike shedding, it basically comes from this story, and I wish I could give the original guy credit. I can't think of it right now, but I mean, we'll put it in the show notes. I think,
yep.
It's a law of triviality. So the story's like this. There's a meeting convened to design a nuclear power plant, right? And they get all the relevant parties there. So it's like the architects and engineers are presenting on what's going to happen. The local communities there, the safety inspectors, the regulators. And so they're talking about the nuclear power plant, and people, they present the plans, and it's just kind of like over everybody's head, or just too complicated, or just too much to think about. And so the plans are presented, and nobody really says anything. There's a few kind of like, softball questions that get answered really quickly. And then, it's a 2-hour long meeting. And so they've only used up half an hour, and they're like, well, what do we do for the last hour and a half? And they're like, oh, well, let's talk about the bike shed that is going next to the nuclear power plant. And they all of a sudden, like, the meeting comes alive, and everybody has opinions. And it's like, there's somebody who wants a new racking system for the bike shed. They, paint colors are discussed. And it's this principle, it's meant to illustrate that sometimes like the amount of time that we devote to a decision is like inversely proportional to how important the decision is. And it's one of those cool things, because it was initially proposed as a concept, and then the behavioral science has shown that yes, this is in fact what happens. And one of the big reasons it happens is because those big decisions are sometimes too uncertain, and we don't like the uncertainty, so we kind of go away from the uncertainty and try to answer something that's more resolvable. So if you're like, oh, green or pink paint for the bike shed, that's something that we can check off, whereas what should the regulations be for the nuclear power plant, or should we talk about this cooling tower? Those are things that are obviously like the time invested in talking about those would be more more useful, but they're not open and shut decisions, right? You're just going to move the needle one way or the other a little bit, which would be, again, way more useful. It's funny. You posted that quote on LinkedIn, and I saw it, and I had just said it, 2 days before. I think I was referring to passwords, because it's what I've see it in passwords, where it's like the more complicated, the less important the situation is that the password is protecting, like the more complicated the password process.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Anyway,
I have an equivalent at Second City. So, when you're putting up an original show at Second City, it is not a minor thing, right? So we're a legendary comedy theater. This could be making and breaking people's careers. They understand that they have a legacy to live up to. We're creating this out of nothing. We don't let you write. You're improvising in front of audiences, and you're trying to gauge the zeitgeist, and you're dealing, especially right now, with, people who are very offended by the opinions sometimes that show up on our stage. Uh-huh. So Mick Napier, who's a legendary director at Second City, talks about the fact that he'll be having his meetings before he goes into process with the cast, and there'll be a first-time performer, an actor, who's like, yeah, it's really important to me to play this instrument in the show because I play guitar, I want to play guitar. He's like, absolutely, you can play guitar. He has no intention of actually having them play guitar. It's just that they have this thing that they can do that they want to hold on to, and he recognizes that it's like a security blanket. Let them think they have it, and then we'll go do our work. So I think there are ways that you can actually manipulate the bike shedding a little bit to be like, yep, let's talk about the bike shed, get that out of your system, and then we're going to go do the work.
Interesting. Yeah. So you just, and maybe try to like get through it as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it, again, this is like to not to, it's another instance where the original illustration of this fundamental concept of like how our brains work and how we do things in the world is from the physical environment. And so much of the bike shedding examples, like if you Google it on the internet, it's all about like decision making. It's not necessarily about decision making as it relates to physical spaces. But yeah, and I think the other way around it, I think, is just to, you know, having like important but manageable, right? It's like, so it is, you know, in the original example, for, you know, if the engineers come in and give all the technical details of the nuclear power plant to these people who like, it's not their job to understand that doesn't work. So if you want people to focus on the big problems, you've got to figure out how to make the big problem that they can actually think about, like, intelligible to them, right? And so maybe it's in addition to getting through the small bike shed decisions, framing the big decisions in a way that people can actually have an opinion on them.
I want to talk to you a bit. This in chapter 5, which is called Enjoy, you write, quote, "Research has repeatedly shown that mere exposure to something makes us like it better, even when we have no memory of being exposed at all," end quote. So my wife released her book Funnier last year in the fall, and it's basically her comedy theory. And the root of that comedy theory is that all comedy has three things in it. It has pain, distance, and recognition. She used to call recognition truth, but then she realized it actually didn't need to be true. It just needed to be recognizable to the audience. And the example we often give is, if in the first act you have a guy playing a character, a funny character, and then the second act you just see that character walk the back behind the action and leave the stage, you will get a laugh simply because they recognize that he hasn't done anything, has done nothing funny. You just recognize that character, or you recognize someone's like this. And so I thought that idea of that thing that we know is very powerful in comedy, but doesn't seemingly make sense, it actually does because of what you're talking about.
Yeah. I love those people in the real world too, right? Who just show up and you laugh because
yes. How are they here?
Yeah. It's like, and so one of the classic examples of mere exposure is that, and it's with all the senses. So you know, it's one of the reasons that, you know, songs get stuck in your head, and then you like them more after listening to them more times, and the familiarity is just more comfortable to your brain, which makes you like it more. They did one of the original studies was with like unhatched eggs, and then when the chicks hatched out of the unhatched eggs, some of them were hearing music, and when the unhatched eggs or when the chicks came out, the ones that had heard the music like gravitated toward the music after they came out in the world. And that's like an extreme example of it, but you know, it's just, we like what we've been surrounded by, and that's a good, and it kind of applies across a bunch of scales. So it's like, okay, what have we been surrounded by in our immediate, like in the last year, but also what was your kitchen like as a kid?
Right.
That's going to feel comfortable. And then all the way back, it even applies kind of to our ancestors as well. Right. It's like if places with views and protection have been good for our ancestors, that still appeals to us now, right? Like sitting on a beach under an umbrella and looking out at the ocean is pleasing. It's not like we're going to get attacked by something or we need to hunt for animals out in the ocean, but there's an evolutionary basis for that too. So anyway, we like what we've been surrounded by. It's a good rule for what we're going to like with our spaces.
Yeah. I read no parenting books. I don't know about you. My wife read every parenting book known to man, but we didn't. I don't ever recall a coordinated conversation about how we were going to parent, to be honest with you. My wife did her thing, I did my thing. But part of, we're so complimentary as a couple because we're both huge readers. House is just filled with books. But we never said to our kids, like, you have to read. We just had books. And in the case of my daughter Nora, she read them very young age. She read, like, went through all the Harry Potters. Nick clearly had a learning disability of some kind that we never got diagnosed, and it was hard for him to read, so he listened to books on tape. Of course, now Nick Leonard walks around with a giant book at all times. He eventually became a reader. He also cooks, and this is a thing that his mom always did. Like, that she loved, we always had meals together as a family. We cook. That's very important to us. It's very social. We have conversation. And I just like that he has brought those things, seem to bring him joy in his life as he's gotten older. And his various partners over a period of time always love the fact that he can cook. Like, that, you know, and Andy Reid's. It's like, this is like very big plus, which is why they put up with the fact that he's a, you know, poor Shakespearean actor.
Oh, come on. poor, economically poor, not poor.
Economically poor. Yeah, yeah. Rich, rich in heart.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that I've done now that Ezra's like watching, can see me, I would always read on my phone or on a Kindle. And I've taken to reading books just so that he sees me, sees the books.
Oh, funny. That's funny.
But it's true. I mean, it's like, so this is, I mean, you know about social norms, right? And one of the most powerful levers of behavior, right, is people seeing you do that behavior, right? And so the book is making this visible. But that's one of the huge advantages our surroundings have, is that they're visible, right? Every time somebody comes into your office, they're seeing your stack of books and you're sending a message about the importance of books. It's just a really powerful lever that we have to make change beyond ourselves.
So the end of the book I had read, because I'm in the book. Don't want to be in the book. I love being in people's books. Don't love the reason I'm in the book. Right. And I know it's hard for you to write because you were nearly finished with the final draft when Josie died. Mm-hmm. I haven't written the follow-up to Yes and in part because it involves Nora's story, losing our daughter. You and I talked about it. It very powerfully fits into the book, in part of how you had to think about, and the way we've thought about, our daughter not being here, but there's space for her. And right. That's a thing you guys were confronting. So talk to us about how the road to Josie's Way. What was the road to that?
Yeah. So, I mean, Josie just unexpectedly died on Christmas, and she was 4 in 2023, and I just got sick, and that was it. And I don't know. I mean, I think obviously it's super hard. One of the things that happened to me in that moment was to think about, obviously, like, who do I know that this has happened to that's like still moving forward in the world? Which is, you know, so I really appreciated people like, you know, you, that having shared your story with Nora, and then also, you know, other people in my life who I knew. And so that part was helpful. And that was kind of part of the reason of not, you know, obviously not taking that story out of the book, because like you said, I was finished with the draft. I mean, I had the sandcastle stories and everything was
they were all there
with Josie, I mean, because she was I'm seeing the world through her eyes during this time. And then I knew that, I remembered from our conversation that you had, that there was a Sun and Moon Park for Nora, which, just sounds amazing. And I think, correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong, but I think one of the things I liked about that, number one, you're like remembering your daughter and putting her into a space that she clearly would have liked, and that, you know, kind of spreads her spirit for other people to see. But you also were making kind of a larger statement about, you know, why are we hiding death, right? I mean, this is like a memorial, but it's also a playground. It's a place where people can be. And so that got me thinking, I mean, about ways to remember Josie in the physical world in a way that's, you know, it remembers her, but it's also something that she would have enjoyed doing and that, you know, other people would enjoy doing. There's a funny, like, she was just like a perfect 4-year-old and a perfect 4-year-old girl, like knowing what girls are going to have to do, like go through in this world. And she was so, like, just knew exactly what she wanted and was so like so good at like explaining her boundaries and telling people what to do for her. But we would walk between our house and there's a pond on campus where we would go fishing or just like walk around and throw rocks in. Or and every time we went there, Josie would want to go a different way. And so one time we went and we're going through it's now owned by the university, but it's just an old like old house. So we're walking, traipsing through their yard, then traipsing through their English ivy. And then there's a path to get from the house back to the road and on our way. And the owner, like trying to live on through their spaces, had like carved the name, the family name in marble. And I think it said like Volino Lambeth or something. And Josie looks at this carving. And of course, one benefit of being four is that, and not being able to read, is that you like the words, the letters say whatever you want them to say. Mm-hmm. And she points at it and she says, "Oh, this is Josie's way." So this is like one of my favorite stories that like, it was so fun, but it also like perfectly captured her spirit, where it was like the like she was going to go her own way in the physical world, but she also had her, like she knew the double meaning of Josie's mm-hmm. way. And so that kind of inspired, okay, can we create a path for her? And so now we've got like next to the best playground in Charlottesville, there's a Josie's Way that, you know, just kind of runs parallel to the playground, and it goes over creeks and through the woods. I was out there a couple weeks ago. I mean, it was absolutely perfect, a perfect story. Every time I go out there, there's kids, and that makes me really happy. And I think would definitely make Josie happy. But this particular time, there were two, they must have been between three and five, and they were the two boys, and it had just snowed here, but the snow was melting. So basically on the way down, the path was all icy. And then once you got to the bottom, it wasn't icy anymore. So the two boys had walked away from their mom down the path over the ice, and the moms had stayed up at the top talking. And then the boys were down at the bottom playing. And then all of a sudden the moms were like, "All right, it's time to come back now." And the boys were like, "No, you come down here. It's fun." And the moms were like, "No, we're going to go." And they're like, "Well, we can walk up to the other side of the path and, you know, come around that way." And the moms were like, "No, we're telling you, you got to come back." And then the boys were like,
"Nope,
we're not coming." We're gonna stay there. It was just this standoff, which Josie would have loved. So it's been nice to, you know, to have that, and to, you know, all the, you know, it's a place to remember her. It's a place to kind of put her spirit into the world. I think that's, if you think about, and that's also why I wanted to keep her in the book, is, you know, this is just a way for people to know the lessons and the things that she shared while she was here. And then I've had graduate students will send me, "Oh, we made a Josie's Way in Michigan," or, you know, mm-hmm. they're not as elaborate as the one that we have here. But again, it's like that, her spirit spreading around, which I'm sure you thought about this with Nora, but you're like, okay, what would this person want? And you probably have much more of an understanding of it with Nora because she was older, but like Josie was a 4-year-old and could, you know, she couldn't articulate it, and she definitely couldn't, she probably didn't even know herself, but I'm pretty convinced she would want people to be sad for a little bit. And then she would want people to be living their lives how she would have. And I think these Josie's Ways would make her happy. And I know that they're, you know, useful for the people who are using them now.
Yeah. I mean, it's a thing that we didn't consider. I like my parents where they're buried, traditional sort of, you know, cemetery, mm-hmm. they have plots for us apparently.
Okay.
Like, but I'm not going to go, like, I don't want to be there. Like, I don't, you know, like, right. That's not, and I don't have a game plan. Like, I've actually, like, I'm going in for this heart surgery. I better have a game plan, which is probably going to tell my son he needs to stick my ashes into Wrigley Field. Is probably what I'm going to want, or something like that. Maybe a little bit at Second City somewhere, under the stage or something. I don't know. I got to think about that. But what I've recognized, like, there was a point where I'd switched therapists, and we're back meeting in places, so we're sort of through the first part of COVID, and to get to from Second City to the therapy office, I would drive past Nora Sun and Moon Park, and it was really useful. And then I would go home, and I'd sort of see it on the way home too, but it became part of my process in terms of like, okay, I'm having this talk therapy, but also I was doing EMDR and other stuff, so it was yeah. physical, and then there was space, and then the space of what is home without her, and we still haven't touched her room.
Yeah, same. I mean,
I mean it's 8 years. Like I'd be like, I'll go. Like I realized a bunch of my wool socks. Like, where did these wool socks go? And I'm like, I bet Nora stole them. And I literally went in. I found like four pairs of these really nice wool socks that she clearly stole from my drawer. And so I took those back. But it was an enjoyable experience, to be honest with you, because it made me laugh. And it's not a mausoleum, and it's not a shrine, and it's not any of that. We just haven't touched it, so I don't. You know, we'll see. We'll see when we get to it.
Yeah. And then again, it's just another instance of like kind of recognizing that the space is not, it's not just another instance, but it, recognizing that the space is going to shape your experience of this huge life event. And, and it's an opportunity. Yeah. It's just, I mean, I think the sock example is really interesting because you're effective, you're using that space as a way to feel the way that you want to feel. Right. And
that's right.
Right. And it's like, I'm not going to go in there just to feel horrible. Sometimes I will probably.
Yeah. I did that. I used to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If I want to cry, I know that'll be a surefire way to do it. But also, hey, if I go in there and find these socks, I mean, that'll be funny. And that'll be like that's like a cool way to connect with her again, right? Because you can all see her laughing like, ha, 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 dad, you finally found them.
Exactly. And it's funny, too, because Nick's room has not changed since he was like a child. Like we put stuff up maybe occasionally. He has a an Al Gore for president thing on his wall that we put up at, you know, so it's like he doesn't care. It is not Nora's room is designed specifically completely in terms of where that 17-year-old girl, which it did this mostly when she was 16 before she got sick, but it was like it's also that, so it's like I don't think it would be the same with Nick's room because he doesn't give a crap. Like it doesn't speak to who he is now. He's not sentimental. This is the other crappy thing about like Ann and I are realizing like Nick's going to want nothing like of ours. Like Nora would have wanted everything. She would be like, I want the house. I want this. I want everything in the basement. It's like, oh, you're completely, we're stuck with the one who wants nothing. So, all right.
Oh man.
It's wild.
But in that case, by changing the room you're giving, or by not changing the room you're giving, or by leaving the room and by not caring about it, you're doing what he would want to do. So.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right. So we always end the podcast with a returning guest for a thank you because story. You have one for us?
Yes. And I mean, it's not heavy because we've done some heavy stuff. Yep. But so I was reading my son's in fifth grade now, and I was they invited people in to listen to the kids do poems. They've got a great teacher who's like goes all the way through the editing process with them. And so like the kids have these poems written, and then the adults come in and say, you know, listen to the poems, read the poem back to the kid. And then the teacher had given us like a list of prompts, you know, like, okay, if they don't say anything, you can ask like, well, what's this about? What does this mean to you or whatever? I was listening to these poems, but, there's a kid in Ezra's class who's also on his soccer team. And this kid is like, he's like the alpha, like in the best way possible, but the alpha fifth grade, like soccer player guy. And he comes up to me and he's got this poem about a lion. It's like the lion is prowling the wilderness and it like, there's bones crackling. And then at the end, it like kills a wildebeest and eats it. And so I'm like, okay. I went through the prompts and I was like, oh, so this poem, what does it mean to you? And he's like, what do you mean? It's a lion eating. And I said, so then I was like, kind of like pushing him as well. Are you the lion? Or, you know, does the lion represent something? He's like, no, it's just a poem about a lion killing a wildebeest. And I said, so then I just said, well, yeah, thank you. Because everybody else kind of had some kind of hidden meaning in their poem. And then he said, yeah, I didn't want to do it like that. So that was the thank you, because it got me through the conversation.
Oh my God. That's so brilliant. It's just like, hey man, you do you, you, yeah. You're like, you know, I get how other people use poetry. You just want a literal thing. You go for it. Oh, that is beautiful. The book is called In a Good Place, how the spaces where we live, work, and play can help us thrive. Laddie, it's always great talking to you.
Yeah. Likewise, Kelly. This was fun.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.